Welcome to You're Making It Worse. I'm Elliot Glazer.
I'm Brent Sullivan.
And I'm H. Allen Scott.
We're here. We're queer.
Meh.
Textual healing.
So, Hilton, the hotel brand, currently has an ad campaign for Hilton Honors that promotes the idea that anyone who takes advantage of the scheme will receive celebrity treatment just as if they were Paris Hilton. Now, here's where that becomes problematic. It has run afoul of the right-wing hate group 1 Million Moms.
Oh, they're so level-headed and rational.
Yeah, very reasonable. The commercial features Paris Hilton in an all-pink ensemble strutting through a hotel lobby. Other customers, men and women, enrolled in the scheme are similarly dressed head-to-toe in pink, clutching handbag-sized dogs and extolling the virtues of membership. 1 Million Moms saw this ad as flaunting, quote, an alternative lifestyle to sell their services. It should be noted that Hilton, for many years, has had a has been very welcoming and has had a fantastic review on the HRC Corporate Equality Index. And I will also throw out this article, which was in, I'm sure it was Autostraddle, this article that was sent to me by Elliot, said that 1 Million Moms has also targeted in the past Macy's for featuring two non-binary performers in their Thanksgiving Day parade and how the mighty have fallen eHarmony for having a gay couple in their commercial. And if you guys remember, barely even what, 6-8 years ago, eHarmony famously did not want, like, it was founded by that dipshit who was in their commercials for so many years. I believe in love or whatever he was like. And he wouldn't have gay people on his platform because he didn't believe it was conducive to long-term relationships. And they sued, and the company actually didn't even go to court. They just kind of, they backed down and they started allowing gay people on their platform. So it's incredible how far they've fallen since their glory days.
Also, 1 Million Moms recently had a viral moment on 60 Minutes where I believe they were talking about transgender kids or something. I forget what the exact issue was that they were discussing, but the reporter was doing a fantastic job basically getting them to say, so you won't answer these questions. Like, he was asking very rational questions, and they just kept going back to their talking points. Clearly, they did not want to talk about the things that he was asking about. And look for the video. I mean, I'll look for it and try to post the link in our show notes. But like, it was such a wonderful moment of just a great reporter being like, "You're full of shit," and I'm gonna make you so that you look like you're an idiot here because you can't back what you're saying up.
But what are they calling an alternative lifestyle about the commercial? Are there like
so? It is
gay
it is
guys
men,
or women.
It's men and women all wearing pink. So it would be men wearing pink. It's like the, you know, what California draw, like Paris Hilton California draw. So like very kind of gay affect, even though there are, you know, straight men in the commercial with their wives, they're still talking like they're like, in, you know, they're Paris Hilton. So I think
and they're saying sliving, which is what Paris Hilton's saying now. And it's very like, it's like slaying and living. It's
one
like
woman's, which says one woman even says slay, which is drag queen slang and therefore part of the gay agenda lexicon. I mean, that is so nuts that like, it's just like you guys really are like,
I always think shit like this is good because like it just reminds people how freakish and extreme these organizations tend to be. Because I think, you know, I think the overwhelming majority of regular people will see that ad and not bat an eye and to think
But I will say that like I hear that and I think you're correct. However, I do worry though. With it being an election year, this group knows what they're doing. They know exactly. And it's like what I've said time and time again, that like the whole reason why they're outraged by this is because it stirs up anger in a very niche part of the voting population so that they stay angry enough to then go to the polls and vote for the candidates that they want them voting for. And they don't actually care about this ad. They don't care about what Hilton does to honor, you know, equality or inclusion. They only care about making a certain part of the voting population in states like Michigan angry.
Incensed,
so that
sure.
so that they go to the polls. And it's all a part of a bigger picture that they're trying to do. The actual issue or the actual thing they're angry about actually doesn't matter, and they aren't angry about it. They only are trying to make other people who aren't as educated about this a little angry so that they do what they want them to do.
Yeah. It barely even exists. They said this ad is inappropriate on many levels and is attempting to desensitize viewers. Mm-hmm. Which is like, no, they're not. Like, they're not trying to desensitize anybody.
Have you ever met someone who like growing up, did you know anyone who was that type of conservative?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh,
Alan, yes. You did.
Yes, I had. There was a I think he's still one of the representatives in my area, but there was a father in my school who that then later became, I think, a school board person or whatever. I don't know. But he was so like farcically right in a way that he had issues with things that just weren't issues and things that we weren't even caring about. And and I remember as a kid hearing some of his positions and being like, no one's talking about this, and not like in a bad way. It's like, no one cares. Like, where have you heard this? And I didn't see the roots of it then, because obviously it was a different time and I was a kid and I didn't get all of that. But now looking back, it's like, oh, this is all just like carnival barkers who are out there, and their whole goal is to make you incensed or angry or shocked enough to pay attention so that then you're listening to them when they tell you to do XYZ. And it really does feel that. But the thing is, I will say to their, I mean, I don't want to give them much credit, but to their credit, they also feel that the left is also doing that too, with the sort of, you know, activism of like even today. I mean, we're recording this on Easter and Trans Day of Remembrance, and President Biden posted a thing about honoring Trans Day of Remembrance. And of course, people are incensed about that he would do this on the holy day of Easter and all of these things, when in reality, it's like Trans Day of Remembrance has always been March 31st. It just happens that Easter is today, and that's why he did
Easter
it.
Today,
but they're just incensed about that. And it's like, they don't need to be. They don't need to be incensed about that. Nope. They could do other
things. You don't need to spend an infinite. You don't have to spend second having any feelings about it if you don't need to. You don't have to.
Yeah,
exactly. You don't have. You can choose not to, and yet
that's the curse of, you know, Alan's best friend, social media. You know, these are conversations that used to exist in the privacy of our living rooms. A husband would vent to his wife
or pundits, like pundits and shows.
And this has been yes, I hear your point about social media, but it also has existed in other forms for decades and decades and decades, from the church pulpit to editorials to different ways in which people, I mean, you look at the rise of Reagan and how he did it and what he did to the Christian right, and how they literally use church pulpits to push a political message and agenda. And it's like, that was just another form of people putting fake news out on Instagram. It literally was. And it's been going on since we started politicking in the beginning of this country, but in lots of different ways.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I think it has been taken to the umpteenth degree recently.
Not even joking.
We are joined today by the wonderful podcaster, comedian, and person who lives next door to a fire station.
That's right.
Hallie Kiefer. Hello, Hallie.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Yes, I live right next door. Constantly. It's basically my roommate at this point, the fire truck.
Wow. I was telling you before we started recording that I grew up next to a fire station, and there's I don't know if this is the case at all fire stations, but in the Midwest, at least because of tornadoes and stuff, there's like a massive siren at the fire station that will alarm whenever if the tornado's coming or something. And Brent, you were saying you were terrified about it. I was excited for a tornado because I was just like, I was always like, I wanted it to be that episode of Roseanne where like we all were hiding in the basement and it was like, oh, fun times. We get to hide in the basement today. You know, did you guys, I mean, Hallie, you're from Ohio originally, right?
Oh, yeah. I remember. Oh, we were constantly in the basement. It's interesting because both my parents voted for Bernie. But at the time, this was the 90s. So my distinct memory of like the power going out, we were in a rural, like rural Northeast Ohio, power going out. We're all like huddled under blankets. My dad has like the crank radio. Yeah. Is listening to Rush Limbaugh or Dr. Laura for hours.
Dr. Laura.
Dr. Yeah. Laura, bringing it back. And it's so funny, just like my what my parents were like, no, related to the theme of the podcast, like who they were in the 90s versus now is very funny. And also being so terrified to go to the bathroom because it was like, I have to get up. In my mind, it was like, if I get up from like the blanket pile with my family, the tornado will come in that moment, right? Yes. I was convinced. Yes. So great childhood times.
I was saying, every time that alarm went off, which I think it only happened in elementary school. I only remember it going off in the middle of the night in our old house in Ann Arbor. And it was like I was the first one down those stairs as if I dove into the basement at any point expecting the house to be like lifted off its foundation. Oh, and wow. Of course, like in hindsight, you're like, yeah, tornado, like actually destructive tornadoes don't really hit Michigan.
I mean, in Missouri,
you'd all hear this tornado alert and run into the basement in preparation for it. You're being hit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't know what's going to happen. Or if you're at school, see, I'm from Missouri. So like tornadoes are like a big deal in Missouri and they happen.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm shocked that you only got it once, Brent, because for me, it felt like we got it like at least 3-4 times a year where we'd have a moment of like tornadoes coming. And so it got to be sort of second half. But I remember being in school one time and we had to like go duck in the hallway. Like we had to do like the whole like position in the hallway for a period of time. And then we had to wait for the storm to clear for our parents. And it was such an exciting night because we got to stay at school until like 7 p.m.
Okay, that is cool. That is awesome.
I was like, ooh, I'm a special person. Everyone else wants to be me. I'm in danger. Yeah. Put me in a TV movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Hallie, sorry for co-opting this with my narrative of my exciting childhood.
Oh, it's really bringing me back. You know, all those near-death experiences as a child, you know, just nostalgia.
How are you doing?
You know, I'm okay. I feel like I have Monday off, and whenever I have an extra day off, I'm like, I'm going to do everything in my, you know, all my to-dos. Instead, I'm just thinking about politics and thinking about the world, even just doing nothing, just being on Twitter all day. So mentally bad, but you know what I mean? I can't complain, you know, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, your podcast is a riveting day. Your podcast is hosted by Crooked Media. So being stressed about politics on a Sunday is actually par for the course for where you work, I think.
Yeah, it's funny. We were nominated for an AMB. I don't know if you've had the, I would say it is the award show for people with their original teeth is, I think, the pitch. Trixie Mattel hosted it last week. It was Tuesday at the Marriott downtown. Cash bar, no food. Okay, that's what we're talking about. But it is funny because we got nominated for Best Comedy Podcast, which Love It or Leave It is. But it also does require me to read all the news every day, all day. And I don't know if you read the news all day, every day.
Yes,
it's bad in any amount. So I do think I'm starting to get that thing that Facebook moderators get, that where it's like, oh, yeah, the brain is not meant to receive so much bad news every day. And now I'm doing it on my one, like my precious days off. So how do you guys avoid doing that? I guess maybe I'm seeking your counsel in this moment. How do you guys not do that over the weekend?
I actually was just going to share the fact that I'm, you know, I very much enjoy, you know, reading the news and have historically. But this year I was like, I can't do it. It's making me too mad. It's making me too anxious. And I was like, look, whatever happens at the end of the year is going to happen regardless of whether I imbibe every stat and poll and thought and edit. Honestly, the editorials are the worst. It's like, I don't know why I put so much stock into what some dipshit who works for, you know, the Peoria Picayune or something that somehow enters my feed. And I'm like, oh, what does this guy have to say?
See, I always skip the editorials. I'm always like, they're losers anyway.
Yeah, well, that's what I've started doing. But I've definitely had to. I even unfollowed the Times on Instagram. I was like, I'm tired of this shit. I can't.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you don't follow
the LA Times, but not the New York Times.
Not shocking.
Well, I also unplugged. I mean, once Trump, it was like definitive that he was going to get the nomination. I'm like, there's literally no reason to follow this. It, you know, it's the stage is set, and what am I going to do? Like, kill myself? Again, it's gonna. I can't take it, and I Although
it's
I will say
it's only March. It says the thing is
March.
Like, if you dip back out, you can dip back in. We have months and months of it ahead
so,
of us.
Yeah. It's so long ahead of us. Yeah, but Go ahead.
I have an opposite reaction in that. I mean, I'm in a similar situation, Hallie, in that I work for Newsweek, but I do celebrity coverage there, so it's not like I'm dealing with much political stuff in general. But I am a part of the newsroom, and I hear and see and read everything, and I'm following it. And I kind of have, I mean, maybe because my love of Gayle King has inspired me to be this way, but I obsessively devour the news, and it oddly doesn't depress me. I'm able to process it in a way, I think because of the way in which I work, in that like I am processing the news all day and I'm reading everything and I'm looking over people's stuff and like looking at stuff, but I'm also having The Real Housewives on at the same time as I'm doing that. And oddly that mix. Recipe, yeah. It works so well. I recommend it.
I will say, as you say, I feel like so many people I know, you like reality TV is exactly that. Like it's the break. It's like, great. I could turn off or at least use another part of my brain. And I unfortunately, in addition to my day job, have a horror movie podcast. So I pretty much only watch horror movies. And yeah. I am trying to be more mindful about that because I do think I'm inadvertently causing myself like I've set up the worst possible combination of things. But also I do love horror. And at least that I know it's not real, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a distraction too. So your podcast is called Ruined, and it's a horror. Well, it's what I find about it so interesting is that you do it with a past guest on this podcast, Allison Levy, and it's a weekly podcast. I love the description. A weekly podcast for horror movie Wikipedia readers, which what do you mean by that? And I love it.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It turns out there's a lot of people I would call they're scaredy cats, but there are a lot of people who genuinely
Allison
can't
is one,
watch
right?
horror.
Allison gets
like very vivid nightmares. Like it actually disrupts her sleep. Which I think is interesting, and I think especially as like creatives, I think it's an interesting like reflection of how your brain works. I could watch anything, and you know what I mean. It just goes in my eyes and then into my brain. Yeah. It doesn't bother me, but it's for people who cannot watch horror. And there are, now that we've started it, a lot of people are like, "Oh, I do want to know." Like it's in the zeitgeist that it's an interesting genre, but genuinely cannot watch the visuals. So basically, just a recap of movies that, again, honestly, I was watching anyways. So telling Allison the plot, and I sort of have her guess what happens. And I've sort of inadvertently trained her in, like, the genre of horror. So even if she doesn't watch them, she knows essentially how the genre works.
I worked in a room with a writer who was a scaredy cat and did not want to see horror movies, but
Elliot's a scaredy cat.
Yes, but unlike me, she actively read the Wikipedias of every movie. That was her way of, like, watching them. And I don't care. I don't want to watch them either.
Elliot doesn't like anything that isn't a video about like flowers and puppies or something.
We literally just saw Elliot's mother in that moment, though. Just for the record, with Elliot being like, I don't care.
I don't. It's nonsense to me. I mean, I like. Yeah, I mean, I don't care. I was saying last week because we had Adam Bucci on, and he designs custom made garments based on a lot of horror movie icons because he loves horror movies and scary movies and whatever. And I was just saying, I'm like, I'm not interested in the jump scares. I'm not interested in the like the choosing to be scared, but I do enjoy, I can enjoy like a psychological thriller when there's something a little bit more at play that's less, I can't do like gratuitous violence. It freaks me out. And jump scares, I don't want to jump. I don't want that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's sort of like I could never ride roller coasters, but I feel like there's certain people who enjoy the thrill. I just find them so physically uncomfortable. So especially jump scares, like it is a physically uncomfortable thing. So if you're not getting the thrill, it's like, oh, so I just feel like I'm going to vomit. Like, what am I getting out of
this? What is the point of this? I don't want that.
Hallie, where did your love of horror? And also, too, I want to ask, too, because it is, I feel so often we hear, you know, horror fans be primarily male, often straight, and it's rare to get sort of a female perspective or even a queer perspective on horror, but there's a huge audience of queer and female horror fans out there. So like, where did your love of horror start?
I think honestly it was being raised Catholic. I don't know if anyone else was here, but
did you see Immaculate?
No, not yet. I'm really excited though. I'm probably gonna go tomorrow.
I'm gonna text you afterwards because I have thoughts. I have thoughts.
Okay, great. I think it honestly, I've thought a lot about this, and I do think that unfortunately that is it. It's a religion based on horrific stories about not simply Jesus is just the tip of the iceberg. Then you got to learn all the saints. They're all horribly mutilated and murdered. And I think in the past, they're like, yeah, we'll just tell them this and that'll make them believe or whatever. And now looking back, it's like, well, that was the worst thing you could tell a child. I don't know. Like, there's something about like Americanness and Catholicism that I think is deadly. But I also, I've always loved it. I was always more of a comedy person. And then like now, since I've come out, it really is only horror. Like, I could give a fuck about comedy now, honestly.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly what that is.
Because you've come out as queer, you mean?
Wait, what did I say?
Come out as a horror fan.
Well, yes, finally, I've finally admitted. Oh, I'm also lesbian, but then yes, right. as a horror fan.
Yes.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think there is something.
huge lesbian.
Huge lesbian. It's bigger every day. I'm trying, gentlemen. I'm trying to be a big lesbian. But yeah, there's something. And I think queerness and horror have a lot in common. I mean, in terms of like, you know, sort of the shiny, happy reality we're supposed to be living in. And then like the private trauma and despair that we're all supposed to shut up about. And then. You see, and it's sort of like you see about in art and the world writ large. But yeah, horror is interesting because like there are so many movies that are queer coded, like that, you know. And I feel like now creators are trying desperately to be like, well, it doesn't have to be just the coding. We could just actually have queer movies. Yeah. But I imagine like every other genre, it's like the ones that get made are the ones that they think well, there'll be a big enough straight audience for still. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that's why independent horror is so important, is that you could actually have, you know, sort of queer stories in you know, horror. I saw a really good, I would like to promote a really good horror, a gay horror movie. I believe it's from Iceland that I saw for the podcast. I want to recommend. It's called Rift.
Rift. Icelandic people are beautiful.
Elliot, you're gonna love this because this is more of a gay psychological thriller. It's called Rift. It's from 2017. It's Icelandic. And so it definitely is more of like a thinking, building dread. And of course, it's about the past. And I think a good example of like, yes, being queer is horrifying because of the world we live in. So it naturally lends itself to this genre, like things being revealed, the self, you know. So
I like the sound of that. And I also want to agree with Alan that I think Icelandic people are beautiful.
Yeah.
I think Scandinavian look. There's a Scandinavian look. You could see it in Robin. You could see it in
They have fucked up teeth, but beautiful faces.
But the teeth are part of it. I love a little bit of jagged teeth. Yeah. I love it.
You like a little bit of a monster. Wait, Hallie, I wanted to bring up a little bit of the Catholic part of what you said because it was so interesting. Yes. So when I was leaving Immaculate, my boyfriend Michael and I, we'll go see scary movies. We love horror movies. Mm-hmm. We watch them all the time. Like, it's a thing. But we'll watch the same ones over and over and over again too.
I'm the same way. Yeah.
We don't explore a lot. We're just like, no, Paranormal Activity again. We left Immaculate, and I remember telling him that because I mean he's not really Catholic, but he was like raised Catholic, you know, and I remember I said something like Catholics are crazy, like Catholics really take crazy to another level, and he was like, because I was raised Mormon, and he was like, well, you got like outer space stuff going on. I was like, I know, but like we only have that outer space thing, like that is the one truly weird thing that we have, whereas Catholics have like layer on layer on layer of weird that goes back thousands of years. It's insane how scary Catholicism actually can be.
Yeah, and it's good that of the 9 Supreme Court justices, 6 of them are Catholic. I always say one of them's a good one. You know, they're not all bad.
We got one Jew.
But it's just funny where it's like the most morbid, and I feel like I know some things about Mormonism. I grew up next to Kirtland, Ohio, which is like one of the stop-offs. Mm-hmm. So there's like a big temple, and there's sort of like you could go and watch a video where the actor playing Brigham Young looks like Trey Parker, one of the creators of South Park. And I remember as a kid being like, I'm like, what? How did this? What is this?
Did you ever go to the play that's right by there? Because they reenact. It's near New York, I think. So that's the stopover. They reenact the Book of Mormon every year in a town right near Ohio.
Yeah, 3 hours from Buffalo. So it was like we were on our way. Mm. No, I didn't actually go. My parents went. For fun. I'm not sure. Yeah. But there's a lot of similarities, I agree, in Mormonism. So I feel like I'd love to see a Mormon horror movie with the aliens. Mm. But then, we have to find that Mormon horror director to, like, uplift them, you know. And I assume it would be queer.
The iconography of Catholicism is what makes it really scary. Like, all the symbols and like, blood and weight. I still remember going to church, like, with my friend as a kid and being like, we're eating his blood.
It's weird.
Yeah, we sure
it's
are. I know.
That's wild to introduce to children, and there's it's like built in fear. And like, yeah, it's also interesting to me how like so much of that. There's so much, like I was saying, iconography, but also like, oh my God, I'm blanking on the word, but all of the suppositions that you have to face also cause so much guilt. And to me, there's that is the connection with like Judaism is like there's a cultural guilt about everything, and then in Catholicism, it's like built. It's like a built-in guilt, not into necessarily the culture, but into the scripture.
Yeah.
Yeah. We already know each other, so just to get deep with it. So I came out late. I came out not even 2 years ago. Didn't know. Thank you. Shocking to be here. Couldn't be happier. Of course, all my friends I've ever had are gay. Like, it's just like I'm one of those people where it's like, well, yeah, you never thought about it. But honest to God, like, I've obviously been in therapy about it. But I do think so much of it is like being born in the 80s in a small town. Like, and this, I mean, we went to two Catholic churches. We were alternating. I went like being from a rural area was sort of like you go to church or your life falls apart. Like, it's sort of like, you know, that was sort of it. And how much indoctrination I got so early, and how so much of it is shame and guilt based. And really, I think like what I was going to therapy for is I didn't understand a level like I had sort of taught myself through like confession. I really had such an intensely critical self-monitoring of my own sexuality, but just in general. And I really had to go to therapy to be like, oh, it's like they taught me to think like
that's external.
And luckily, I mean, thank God I found a queer therapist. She's great. I tell her every week, I'm like, you're doing great work. You know, you really brought me a long way. But but it's just so unfortunate. And like, of course, that affects every queer person, but then it affects every Catholic. I mean, like, you see, like, recovering Catholic is no joke. Like that, I feel like that. Like, I finally have gotten enough therapy to not, even if I didn't logically agree with it, I was carrying so much of that thought process where like you analyze yourself for sin and you start so early. Like I started, you go to confession at 7, you know,
you
like you just start as a child.
Talk about the bad things you do to a dude in a box. Like,
and they're all pedophiles. Like that's the other thing we're never going to deal with, you know, like, and it's like, that also makes sense in terms of like how they break people from their sexuality and then like give priests this insane amount of power. Like to me, it's like, oh, it's just, things that we know, we have too much information to keep continuing, and yet people still keep being Catholic, I guess.
Looked at a stat the other day that was basically talking about how a-religious millennials and Gen Zers have become. But they said that, so I guess I didn't read this in a newspaper, but I'm taking it at face value because it was on some legitimate site, right? They said that the Surgeon General has actually been encouraging, and this surprised me, more church attendance because it's it leads to such social isolation. And anyway, it triggered that when you said you were from Northeast, you know, rural Northeast Ohio, and like all you did was go to church. And like, you know, as nefarious as I think the institution of most religions really all can be, I think, you know, on a micro level, you know, people get so much from the, you know, the guiding philosophy of religion. But also it can be destructive as well, as you're explaining.
Yeah, I think and I honestly think, unfortunately, this is like another challenge that the queer community has to take up, where it's like, what does community look like? And I again, even in the 2 years I've been out, I've been met so many incredibly kind, gracious, like queer people of all different kinds who have talked to me about this. But it's like, yeah, what is the alternative? And the alternative will have to come, like it has to come out of our community, just because we are the ones who are like, okay, how do we have a community that's not so intensely hierarchical? Like that doesn't have somebody in charge that is monitoring you for sin that we're not paying money into. Like, because on the surface, yes, absolutely. And you're also like, people need community. Like people are so isolated. But then it's like, you want all these good things. Well, guess what? We're going to control your reproductive project.
Right.
You're going to pay us. Like,
you want to go to a potluck? Well, we're going to make sure we control your body for the rest of your life.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, well, it's like, and I, you know, I think it's like, how do we have these good things without the institutions that existing forcing all of that other stuff onto us, especially as queer people?
Well, but also too, I mean, I feel like we're facing two dilemmas here in that, like, if you look at the social infrastructure, like, people met the people in their lives because of, for the better part of the past hundred years, because of school, work, and church, or however you practice your faith. And those were the three temples of how you meet people in your life, how you make connections and anchors and friendships. But for queer people, we didn't really have that. We had the school part, sort of, but we were isolated. We didn't have the church part, and the work part often was in the closet. So those three places didn't work for us to find a life. And so we had the bars. But bars are also inherently toxic because they can lead to a massive amount of problems with drugs and alcohol and all these other things that we become dependent on. And it's like, we're sort of these, even to this day, these lost sort of like people bouncing around being like, how do we build community? Where do we go? What do we do? Like, and there's no real roadmap for it because of gentrification and bars closing and things happening. And like the places that we can go to are being shut down. So it's like, basically, we're fucked is what I'm saying. We're fucked.
Well, I agree. I will say I've stopped drinking, but I'm over at High Tops drinking non-alcoholic beers. I'm like, I have to come and give, like, I'll come to trivia night. I'll buy food, because it's sort of like, if we as a community maybe start drinking less, or our behaviors change as like we have more room in other parts of society, then how do we then fund those sites? You know, like what are they? You know,
I thought that a lot too, because that's another thing that Gen Z is not doing. They're drinking way less than previous generations, and you're like, well, that definitely has a trickle down effect. You know, I think a lot of bars, gay bars and non, you know, are fueled by 21 to 30 year olds, and the fact that their drinking might be down, I forget the numbers, but 20% or whatever it may be, like, that means there probably will be fewer bars. And if that means fewer gay bars, that means fewer gay spaces for people to kind of meet and feel comfortable.
What do you think is the, like, when you think about it, Gen Z is drinking less, having less sex, they're not getting pregnant as teenagers. What, like,
less religious?
Are less they religious,
happier?
Not less marriage. why do we, I mean, either, first, I'm curious why that's happening. And secondly, like, were we at the peak of, I mean, I'm going to just come right out and say it. I feel like we were at the peak of like bad kids syndrome, you know, like getting pregnant, saying yes to drugs and like, you know, get like sex. Everybody
we were
was,
all
like,
a very special episode of Blossom. Yeah,
that's what I mean. Like, how come Gen Z knows, you know, like, it's not the best idea? How do they know what's good for them?
Do you think, I mean, like, my first thought is, like, first of all, the internet. So it's like you're meeting people and making friends online. So it is harder to fuck them. Like, it's just like, well, you're through the screen. We have to, like, make a plan, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's part of it. And then it's like, is it that they are more accepted by their parents or their families? Yeah. Younger. Yes. So then there wasn't this, or wasn't a need for, or a feeling of rebellion. Because I'll be honest, I work with a lot of trans people, and I had never, like, I knew trans people around in comedy, but, like, I wasn't, like, friends with people or hang out with people. And I was talking to this trans non-binary person I know who's from the Bay Area, and they go, after I come out, they're like, you know, I don't think I've ever lived anywhere where I couldn't be myself. And I'm like, that's insane. But also, that is the goal. You know, so it's like, oh, you had such a profoundly different experience than me. It's almost like, did you not have to rebel? Like, was that not part
of
it?
The coming out experience, we were talking about that on a past episode with our guest Dubs, that the coming out experience is completely different for this younger generation, because it just, the need for it isn't necessarily there. And I think in a lot of ways, like, I mean, I never really had to come out because I was always flaming. and I'm kind of blessed in that way, I feel like. And I don't know. I think the younger generation are experiencing exactly that. They didn't have that sort of, they have other struggles, like financial struggles and debt and those things that we also have too, but they have a lot of it.
Yeah. And I mean, thank, like, God. Like, I think about, you know, coming up in New York and how much I, you know, like, I could piece together what, being 24, and I could, like, blog and pay my rent.
Yes, same.
Literally, blogs don't exist. Like, those jobs were a generation, and then they don't exist. Like, I could, I wasn't getting paid a lot, but you could hustle and make that money. So then, like, I was then able to use that platform to build other stuff in my career. Now those kids don't even, like, those jobs don't exist. That's so insane and horrible. And also, that's also, I feel like, so much of, and this is true of horror movies as well, like, so much of pop culture feels very stifled, like, stultifying right now. And part of that is the pandemic, I think, but the other part is, like, young people can't live anywhere to make art together. Like they're like, it's so much harder to have to be get those the first years going because of how expensive everything is. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. It's an interesting take. Well, Hallie, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an absolute delight. Where can people follow you, support you, love you on the internet?
Please follow me. I'm at Hallie Kiefer on Twitter and Instagram, and you can follow the podcast at Ruined Podcast on both as well, or look up Ruined wherever your podcasts are sold. And then to love me, I guess come to Dyke Night at Thursday Dyke Night at High Tops on Los Feliz, and we can talk. You know?
Oh, I was just there yesterday. I'll come on Thursday.
Well, you weren't there on Thursday. Now were you, Alan?
No, I wasn't.
So
the truth comes out, Alan.
And another thing.
So, it's not only Easter. We're not recording only on Easter and the Trans Day of Remembrance. It's also 15 years of Grindr.
How are you celebrating?
I'm celebrating by reading an article on Dazed by a writer named James Grieg or Greg. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. He had a really interesting approach to talking about Grindr after being around for 15 years. He said it's become a symbol for everything that's wrong with contemporary gay life. He calls it a worrying machine that generates everything from sexual racism and hierarchies of status to depression and disordered eating. And it's responsible for the rise of hookup culture. And it's the reason why it's so hard to find a boyfriend. It's also a coping mechanism, the expression of a community-wide childhood trauma, which has forced us into a never-ending hunt for validation through fleeting and meaningless sexual encounters. But yeah. I always think of what Alan talks about, too. On the good side of things, there is, of course, the building of community among people who might not have access to other queer people otherwise. And so he talks about that, too. He says it's changed gay sexual culture for the better as well. On one hand, it's been a valuable tool for education and public health. It could be the first time that people encounter terms like PrEP or the idea of regular testing, and that it actually is a helpful app for queer migrants and people from lower income backgrounds who don't necessarily speak English as a first language. And, you know, also it can provide platonic friendships, if you can believe that, and help people find a community. Mm-hmm. So, and he also says, you know, there's the caveat, too, that Grindr may have intensified sexual hierarchies whereby, you know, straight white men are at the top, but it didn't invent the system. So, he's basically trying to, you know, he's trying to see both sides of it. And so, yeah, it's been around for 15 years.
15 years. That is so wild.
Really, really pervasive. No matter what you think about it, it's like, it's really, changed the culture in a way that
even straight people, I just saw this stupid, I don't know if it was on TikTok or Instagram or whatever, but some woman posted a thing being like, if you want to find out if your husband is on Grindr or something, just play the noise in a room full of straight men, play the noise, the Grindr sort of like chat noise, and see which one turns their head.
Yeah, I remember seeing a video that somebody posted too, where it was like, I mean, it was funny. I have to admit it was funny. I wanted to be annoyed, but it was funny. But it was like gay guys just using their phone around like friends or something and then playing the Grindr beat, the noise. Mm-hmm. And the guy would be like, you know, and I thought that was funny because it signified to me what I thought was interesting, which is like, are the person who is doing the prank, is he getting caught? Like, is it bad that he's on it? Is it embarrassing? Mm-hmm. How public can one be about being on, like, is it a bad thing? And so that was an interesting video.
It's also
too.
How that noise, that particular noise, is sort of up there with the Nokia phone ring or the AOL chat, or where it's become a noise, maybe not in a mainstream sense like those other two examples, but at least a case of something that it's a part of, you know, music samples and mixes and like drag mixes and like all these other things where like you instantly know if you're a part of a particular community, you instantly know what that noise is.
That's why it was so funny.
I was gonna say real quick that we have a friend who of course shall remain nameless, but he has suspected that his dad is gay, even though his dad is married to his mom. One day I was like, you know, why do you think that? And our friend told a story of zooming with his dad, and he heard the grinder sound in the background of his dad's side, which is definitely like, you're like, oh, wow, that would be, yeah, that would be pretty decent confirmation, you know? I don't think I know of any other apps. I think we've had this discussion. I don't know of any other apps that use that same sound. Maybe, I'm sure it's probably trademarked, but I don't know.
I'm sure, I'm sure. I mean, it's such a unique sound.
Do you guys think that the 15 years of Grindr has proven it to be helpful or harmful, or is it nuanced? And
I really worry. I mean, this is, of course, coming from someone who has, I actually just deleted Grindr because it was just unworkable. They've had some updates recently that are literally making it impossible to use. And I was like, I've been on for a couple months. I'm like, I don't need this shit in my life. So I'll take at least a month off, but I'm definitely addicted to it. And so, you know, I can't say that it's provided me nothing. It's entertaining. I have met some people over the years. I've had a couple hookups and, you know, lots of dates. So I can't say it contributes nothing, but I definitely worry about its, you know, it and all of online dating's effect on, you know, gay bars, gay spaces, which I think can be, you know, if we actually start to see them disappear, and like the gay club in my hometown is like literally has on the gay night at the dance club, it is like 1/25 what it used to be in that bar. I don't know. What do you think, Alan?
I mean, I think I hear that, but I'm also like, that's inevitable of all spaces for lots of different reasons. You know, the distraction of our lives and how our lives change. It isn't just one app that's causing people not to go to a gay bar. I'm sure that's a big part of it, but I also don't think most people, I mean, we all know on our own track records of going to gay bars, most people aren't hooking up just going to the gay bar. You know what I mean? They're doing it in other ways. So like the gay bar serves other purposes. So I feel like the decline in attendance of gay bars is multifaceted. But I think ultimately, even though I do think it's toxic and it's created a lot of like hierarchical issues and a lot of problems in the community, I also think it is kind of a good thing in that it's allowed people to be sexual in ways that like they may not have had otherwise. You know what I mean? That it's really difficult for a lot of people to be in person outwardly sexual, either at a gay bar or with a partner or with in general, like just to be open and whatever. And if you can use an app to kind of hide behind the robots of an app to be sexual and have a communication, that can be really liberating, I think, for a lot of people. And I think that's a good thing. And I think ultimately there's always going to be a lot of bad with a lot of good, but like, I think I kind of am grateful for that because it's allowed people to sort of like maybe open up a little bit more, and maybe it's allowed them to be open up on other apps to do other things and meet other people and all these things. I don't know. I tend to see it as more of a glass half full situation.
Well, Alan, you have been in a loving, committed relationship for many years, so you don't use Grindr anymore. Elliot, when was the last time you were on Grindr? You've sort of abandoned it too, right?
I mean, I'm with Alan. I kind of see, I sort of see like it 50-50, you know?
Same.
I think it has a lot of toxicity to it, and it's perpetuated that hierarchy, like the writer was talking about. And it's given people, as I think most digital media has, given people the freedom to be bad, be mean, be inconsiderate. But it is a tool that connects people, and I've had friendships come out of Grindr, you know, dates that didn't really pan out, but friendships that came out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't use it though. I mean, it became, to me, it's like, it's such a, it really like is going, it is the app. It is the gay app. And so you can't really avoid it if you're going to be on apps. And yet, even in doing so, I had to stop because I don't get addicted to it. I get turned off by it.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm not, it's too mean. It really, for whatever reason, maybe it's just that one app, but it allows guys to be in the way that I see it, too curt and too flippant about what you look like and how you interact. Like when it makes interactions the most mechanical, unkind and inconsiderate, I don't want it. I can't take it.
It was funny. I just wanted to share this story real quick. I'm sorry, Alan. Did you want to say something real quick?
Well, just that I think I totally hear you, but I also think that, like, you know, with any of these apps, be it Instagram, be it in Twitter, being any of the things, the addiction level is very, very high. And, you know, the things aren't going away. These massive companies aren't going away, and they're not going to stop producing the things that we want to be viewing on our phones. So I think, for me at least, a lot of the conversation needs to be pointed towards how do we mentally sort of adapt these things into our lives. How can we, in a healthy mental way, have relationships with these apps while at the same time recognizing their addictive qualities? And like,
and it's hard because an app like Grindr is meant to be essentially, as Brent has said before, like a video game where the goal is to get laid, and that's a lot. That's very, makes you very vulnerable.
That's a very fundamental drive that we have as human beings, which is procreation. And I agree with you, Alan. I think that is certainly a good place to be. I guess sometimes I worry that these apps evolve as well. And so as we evolve, they can evolve. And ultimately, their end goal is always going to keep our eyes as long as humanly possible. But it was kind of funny how Grindr had right before I deleted it, they had like a pop-up survey. They're like, take a survey about Grindr. And I was like, oh, this will be a chance for me to tell them that they fucking suck and that I hate them and all this shit. And it was literally the most elitist series of questions.
Like what?
I don't even know what information they were trying to glean from this. Mm-hmm. But there were questions. First of all, one of the questions was your income bracket, and 0 to $100,000 was just one of 8 options.
What?
I was like, what? It was literally 0 to $100,000, 1 to 2, 2 to 3. I mean, I don't think it was 8, but it was like 5. It was like, how many people are making $450,000 a year? And they're like, excuse me, I'm not 250 plus, I'm 450.
I mean, how many people are making $100,000 a year? Most people are not.
It was insane.
Most people are making 70 something a year.
And then you would have lost your mind. And I was going to screen grab, but I didn't for whatever reason. The questions were even worse after that. They were like, what do you enjoy? And it was like the only option, like, what pastimes do you enjoy?
Pizza.
The only options were like luxurious stuff. It was like luxury travel, luxury shopping. And I was like, what is happening? What are you talking about? It got like personal. They asked questions about like going to the gym or whatever. It was just like, this is literally like written like a horny 19-year-old who wants to see if I'll be a daddy or something.
I feel like the question, and actually that brings me to a great point that we forgot to talk about earlier, but I feel like the question about the gym actually was tailor-made for Elliot, because we received a text in the group chat this week that was perhaps one of my favorite things I think I've ever received from Elliot. He texted about that. It's not uncommon. Let me just read it. It's not uncommon for stuff to go down at my gym, but these days, these two guys were literally fucking in the wide open, LOL, moaning, LOL. It was crazy. And I had to stress that Elliot does go to Equinox, which we've discussed many times before. And I think that if you're paying nearly $300 for a gym membership, that
you should be getting laid.
That is actually a part. I feel like that's one area where Grindr is actually onto something. Maybe Grindr should
that
buy
crazy
Equinox.
I mean, it already essentially has. I mean, it feels like it's the they would put out a questionnaire to their members about whether you make under $100,000.
My favorite. My favorite thing about Elliot going to Equinox, though, is that he goes for, and this is going to be great for anyone watching on YouTube, he goes for the air quotes amenities.
Towels.
Yeah.
He's like, I need the towels. You don't need those towels.
I do need the towels. I do need cold eucalyptus towels. I need them.
So do you think if the towels were discontinued, do you think you would continue? Do you think you would cancel your membership?
Honestly, I think I think I would definitely consider it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Wow. Fair enough.
What would your aunt say?
Brent, what would your Aunt Ramona say about something she heard on today's show?
I was once talking to your Uncle Hamilton, and I heard the grinder noise in the background. Don't ask me how I knew, but I knew, and I sent him to a conversion therapist.
My Aunt Joanne would say, you know, Hallie works for Crooked Media, and Crooked Media was co-founded by John Lovett, ex-boyfriend of Ronan Farrow, also Jewish. Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Ask for his number, maybe? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about Aunt Anne?
My Aunt Anne would say, I don't know what y'all are talking about. I love Grindr. I got this one that's electric, and you just put it over the pot.
So
and
good.
It just, the perfect amount of pepper.
She's so good.
The perfect amount of pepper.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Follow us on patreon.com/you're making it worse.
And go watch the episode. Go watch the episode on YouTube as well at You're Making It Worse. You can follow Brent. You want to go? You want to keep going?
No, I don't want to do it.